We're picking up our study at the story of David's son Amnon and his daughter Tamar. The second portion of 2 Samuel is a very relatively detailed story of events that happened during David's reign. It isn't a chronological story. The chronicler has chosen the particular things that he wishes to include. There's very little politics. Oh, I shouldn't say that. There's plenty of politics. But there's very little foreign affairs, if you will. It's not about what David did in conquering different people. Instead, it's the story of David himself. And it is at the same time encouraging in many ways and yet discouraging. We see over and over again the results of sin, but we see David as a thoughtful man. Not always as decisive as he should be, but influenced in that way by his emotions, his care and concern. So he's a real person. So chapter 13 of 2 Samuel tells an ugly story. In the course of time, that's the chronicler's way of saying that here's a story that occurred and he's not putting it in any particular place. In the course of time, Amnon, that's David's firstborn, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. Why not say Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, his sister, because Absalom is Amnon's brother. But the point that the chronicler wants to make is that there is going to be a clash between Amnon and Absalom. Amnon became frustrated to the point of illness on account of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. So the chronicler is straightforward, and this guy is so bent or so around the bend that because he can't have his way, he's sick. Now Amnon had a friend named Jonadab, son of Shimeah, David's brother. So that would be King David's nephew. Jonadab was a very shrewd man. He asked Amnon, "Why do you, the king's son, look so haggard morning after morning? Won't you tell me?" Now remember, all of these people are involved in the palace intrigues. In the whole family, there's all kinds of things going on. David had a lot on his mind. He was a king, but he also was very interested in the worship of Israel. We don't know exactly when these events are taking place. David didn't always pay attention to the things that he should have seen were going to cause problems. So where there's a vacuum, somebody steps in. So here is Jonadab, who thinks that by helping out Amnon, prince, he's the firstborn son of David, that helping him out will turn out well for him. So he sees that something's wrong, and he says, "Won't you tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Jonadab should say, "Ooh, that's not good. You better stop being concerned about that." But of course, he doesn't say that. "Go to bed and pretend to be ill," Jonadab said. "When your father comes to see you, say to him, 'I would like my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight so I may watch her and then eat it from her hand.'" The story of the chronicler is so spare that it's hard to tell exactly what's going on. David should have spotted this, one would think, from the story, but it seems like he's not catching on very good. Well,
Did he know about it?
Pardon?
Do you think he knew about it?
Well, I think he should have. I don't think he did. But I think that we have to say, you know, perhaps he should have been paying attention. There's all kinds of lessons here. He, as the king, has many wives and concubines and all this other stuff, and it's all a distraction. He isn't the kind of father that he should have been. And his actions have set up all kinds of problems. So, David sent word to Tamar at the palace, "Go to the house of your brother Amnon and prepare some food for him." So Tamar went to the house of her brother Amnon, who was lying down. She took some dough, kneaded it, made the bread in his sight, and baked it. Then she took the pan and served him the bread, but he refused to eat. "Send everyone out of here," Amnon said, so everyone left him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food here to my bedroom, so I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the bread she had prepared and brought it to her brother Amnon, in his bedroom. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her and said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "Don't, my brother," she said to him, "don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of those wicked fools in Israel. Please speak to the king. He will not keep me from being married to you." But he refused to listen to her, and since he was stronger than she, he raped her. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. Gotta love this guy. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." "No," she said to him, "sending me away would be a greater wrong than what you have already done to me." But he refused to listen to her. He called his personal servant and said, "Get this woman out of here and bolt the door after her." So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. She was wearing a richly ornamented robe, for this was the kind of garment the virgin daughters of the king wore. Tamar, she's not going to take this lying down. Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the ornamented robe she was wearing. She put her hand on her head and went away weeping aloud as she went. Her brother Absalom said to her, "Has that Amnon, your brother, been with you? Be quiet now, my sister. He is your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." And Tamar lived in her brother Absalom's house, a desolate woman. So don't let this thing bother you, but of course it is. When King David heard all this, he was furious. Absalom never said a word to Amnon, either good or bad. He hated Amnon because he had disgraced his sister Tamar. We don't understand the language of the Middle East. It would seem like Absalom should have been worried about more than the fact that Amnon had disgraced his sister. But we have to understand how serious an offense that he's talking about. It is the act that was done. So now 2 years go by. 2 years later, when Absalom's sheep shearers were at Baal Hazor near the border of Ephraim, he invited all the king's sons to come there. You can have a barbecue. Absalom went to the king and said, "Your servant has had shearers come. Will the king and his officials please join me?" "No, my son," the king replied. "All of us should not go. We would only be a burden to you." You can't cook that many ribs, you know. So, although Absalom urged him, he still refused to go, but gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon come with us." So they've got to make it a big family celebration. The king asked him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom urged him, so he sent with him Amnon and the rest of the king's sons. Absalom ordered his men, "Listen, when Amnon is in high spirits from drinking wine, and I say to you, strike Amnon down, then kill him. Don't be afraid. Have not I given you this order?" So we'll make it clear. "Be strong and brave. So Absalom's men did to Amnon what Absalom had ordered. Then all the king's sons got up, mounted their mules, and fled. So this terrifying thing happens at this family get-together. So they mount their mules and flee. Interesting, they mount their mules. The horses are too difficult to tame. You can hook a horse to a chariot, perhaps, but riding them doesn't work very well. It takes many centuries of breeding and training to have horses be where they are now. So, while they were on their way, the report came to David, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, not one of them is left. Absalom wants to rule. This becomes very clear. And the possibility, David seems to recognize the possibility that he would get rid of every rival. So David knows about Absalom. The king stood up, tore his clothes, and lay down on the ground, and all his servants stood by with their clothes torn. But Jonadab, son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, "My lord should not think that they killed all the princes. Only Amnon is dead. This has been Absalom's expressed intention ever since the day Amnon raped his sister Tamar. My lord, the king should not be concerned about the report that all the king's sons are dead. Only Amnon is dead." So he helps Jonadab, helps Absalom, and then undercuts him behind his back. He's just not a very good guy. Meanwhile, Absalom had fled. So he wanted to get vengeance. Now the man standing watch looked up and saw many people on the road west of him coming down the side of the hill. The watchman went and told the king, "I see men in the direction of Horonaim on the side of the hill." Jonadab said to the king, "See, the king's sons are here. It has happened just as your servant said." As he finished speaking, the king's sons came in, wailing loudly. The king too, and all his servants wept very bitterly. So it was a sad day. Amnon, the crown prince, is dead. Absalom fled and went to Talmai, son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. This is up to the north. It's family. It's Bathsheba's family. But King David mourned for his son every day, so he's very sad. After Absalom fled and went to Geshur, he stayed there 3 years. And the spirit of the king longed to go to Absalom, for he was consoled concerning Amnon's death. So he's come to the conclusion, well, with Amnon's death, I need to have a relationship with Absalom. It's who's going to succeed him. Joab, son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart longed for Absalom. Joab is one of David's generals. So Joab sent someone to Tekoa. Tekoa is a few miles south of Bethlehem, and its claim to fame for us is who came from there. Amos, the prophet Amos, came from Tekoa. But so in Tekoa, there's a wise woman. Well, wise means many things. She's a great actress. So that's what Joab was interested in. He said to her, "Pretend you are in mourning. Dress in mourning clothes and don't use any cosmetic lotions. Act like a woman who has spent many days grieving for the dead. Then go to the king and speak these words to him." And remember that they in the Middle East, and it's no different today, do not believe in a stiff upper lip. It's completely different from us. If you're going to mourn like David, you throw yourself on the ground and tear your clothes. And so what he's telling her is it should look like you're mourning. We think that's a little weird. they would think that we're weird. So everybody's weird. When the woman from Tekoa went to the king, she fell with her face to the ground to pay him honor, and she said, "Help me, O king." The king asked her, "What's troubling you?" She said, "I am indeed a widow. My husband is dead. I, your servant, had two sons. They got into a fight with each other in the field, and no one was there to separate them. One struck the other and killed him. Now the whole clan has risen up against your servant. They say, 'Hand over the one who struck his brother down so that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Then we will get rid of the heir as well.' They would put out the only burning coal I have left." So she says, "I've only got one thing to keep me going, and they're going to snuff that out. Leaving my husband neither name nor descendant on the face of the earth." The king said to the woman, "Go home, and I will issue an order in your behalf. I will not allow this vengeance to take place." There's no constabulary. There's no police force. If there's a murder, you take care of it within the family. But the woman from Tekoa said to him, "My lord the king, let the blame rest on me and on my father's family, and let the king and his throne be without guilt. So don't take responsibility for this, because it'll look bad for you." The king replied, "If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he will not bother you again." So, a little threat there. She said, "Then let the king invoke the Lord his God to prevent the avenger of blood." That would be the family getting even with the murderer. "To prevent the avenger of blood from adding to the destruction, so that my son will not be destroyed." Well, Joab knows David very well. And he knows the seriousness with which he would take his relationship with the Lord. So he tells her everything that she says, Joab is telling her, get him to swear an oath. "As surely as the Lord lives," David said, "not one hair of your son's head will fall on the ground." Then the woman said, "Let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." "Speak," he replied. The woman said, "Why then have you devised a thing like this against the people of God?" The very same thing that I told you in the story is what is happening in the royal family, and it affects the nation. This is Joab's concern. When the king says this, takes this oath not to to prevent the avenger of blood, does he not convict himself? For the king has not brought back his banished son. So you will save my son, but you won't do the same for Absalom. Like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be recovered, so we must die. Everyone's going to die. But God does not take away life. Instead, he devises ways so that a banished person may not remain estranged from him. We're all going to die, but God can work out a way. "And now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. Your servant thought, 'I will speak to the king. Perhaps he will do what his servant asks. Perhaps the king will agree to deliver his servant from the hand of a man who is trying to cut off both me and my son from the inheritance God gave us.' And now your servant says, 'May the word of the Lord, of my lord the king, bring me rest. For my lord the king is like an angel of God in discerning good and evil. May the Lord your God be with you.' Then the king said to the woman, 'Do not keep from me the answer to what I am going to ask you.'" I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to answer it. "Let my lord the king speak," the woman said. The king asked, "Isn't the hand of Joab with you in all this?" So he knows that Joab is the one who wants there to be a reconciliation. So when we ask whether David knows these things, you know, whatever it may be, I think it's not very accurate for us to say, "Oh, well, he was really completely clueless about what was happening." But David is not a politician. He's not, his heart lies with the worship of Israel. That's what he does very, very well. So, the woman answered, "As surely as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything my lord the king says." You know, if you ask me to answer, then I'll answer. "Yes, it was your servant Joab who instructed me to do this and who put all these words into the mouth of your servant. Your servant Joab did this to change the present situation. My lord has wisdom like that of an angel of God. He knows everything that happens in the land." So David knows what Joab was up to and why. "The king said to Joab, 'Very well, I will do it.'" So now Joab is there. "Go bring back the young man Absalom." Joab fell with his face to the ground to pay him honor, and he blessed the king. Joab said, "Today your servant knows that he has found favor in your eyes, my lord the king, because the king has granted his servant's request." Then Joab went to Geshur and brought Absalom back to Jerusalem. But the king said, "He must go to his own house. He must not see my face." So David, you know, says, yes, you can bring him back, but after Joab has left, he thinks better of the whole thing. I mean, Absalom is still coming back, but David is not going to allow Absalom in the palace. So all of this leads us to think that David really has Absalom's number too, as well as Joab. He's got this thing figured out. He knows what's going on. But he just, it's just too difficult for him to deal. I mean, it's hard to say. Now you're really getting speculating about David. But we need to think past just the outward part of the story. So Absalom went to his own house and did not see the face of the king. You don't just walk in and see the king. "In all Israel, there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the top of his head to the sole of his foot, there was no blemish in him. Whenever he cut the hair of his head, he used to cut his hair from time to time when it became too heavy for him. He would weigh it, and his weight was 200 shekels by the royal standard." So, it's, you know, there's all kinds of estimates of weight. The NIV note has 5 pounds. Other guesses are 3 pounds. The problem is we don't know what the royal standard of a shekel really was. But he's got beautiful hair. 3 sons and a daughter were born to Absalom. So life goes on. The daughter's name was Tamar, and she became a beautiful woman. He names her after his sister. Absalom lived 2 years in Jerusalem without seeing the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab in order to send him to the king, but Joab refused to come to him. So he sent a second time, but he refused to come. Then he said to his servants, "Look, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there." So it's probably the spring of the year. "Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Absalom gets what he wants. He's centered in Absalom. Then Joab did go to Absalom's house, and he said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Absalom said to Joab, "Look, I sent word to you and said, 'Come here so I can send you to the king to ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me if I were still there. Now then, I want to see the king's face. I want to be in his favor. And if I am guilty of anything, let him put me to death.'" So let's have this out. So Joab went to the king and told him this. Then the king summoned Absalom, and he came and bowed down with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So David reaches out to Absalom, but it's not going to go well. In the course of time, so again, we're not putting all the events together in some chronological fashion. We're just being told what happened. "In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him." In the Psalms, David wrote about not counting on chariots and horses. But Absalom ignores that, and he's putting himself up as a powerful man. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate, Jerusalem. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" He would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel," whatever it may have been. Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there is no representative of the king to hear you." So he lies. You're not going to get anywhere with the king. Forget it. But you've got a good case. So Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me and I would see that he gets justice." So over a period, a long period of time, Absalom is undercutting David. I imagine that advisors to David would have said to him, "You better watch out for Absalom." But David just can't bring himself to deal with his son. So, verse 5, "Also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him," which the king would not normally have done. So again, it's just another way for Absalom to say, "I'm just one of the buds, you know, one of the guys, and I would make a much better king than David, who is pretty unapproachable." Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice, and so he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. At the end of 4 years, so this is a patient plot on Absalom's part, Absalom said to the king, "Let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord." Well, I suspect that that really moved the heart of David, because I don't gather from everything that happened that Absalom was a particularly pious fellow. And so now he tells David, "Well, I've made a vow, and so I'm going to go up to Hebron to carry out that vow." And David says, "Well, that's a sign of good things." So, "While your servant was living in Geshur in Aram, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron." it's with a little guilt here. Because he says that he asked the Lord to bring him back. Well, David was the one who was preventing him from coming back. So, yes?
It just dawned on me that they said at the end of 4 years. So it took him 4 years to remember that he was going to praise God for bringing him back.
Yeah.
6 years after he's been back.
Well, he's got to pay back his vow, yeah. Well, and see, I think that David is just willing. You've all met parents who just can't say no to their children. And you really don't want to be around the kids. If you raise children without saying no to them, they may do well. It depends on how you measure it, but you don't want them next door. David did not carry out his responsibilities. So the king said to him, "Go in peace." So he went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron." So we'll send out messengers and they'll blow the trumpet and we'll get everybody to rise up and declare Absalom king. 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, his consigliere. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. Now, why were people willing to abandon David? Well, you know, again, the chronicler just isn't interested in telling us every turn and bend of the story. But People are thinking perhaps that David is just too preoccupied, who knows what. We don't really know. So, a messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." We got a problem. There's a rebellion. Then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, "Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom." So David knows his son. "We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin upon us and put the city to the sword." So Jerusalem is David's capital city. He wants to save himself, his men, and he doesn't want the city to be sacked, so he's got to get out of there. The king set out with his entire household following him, but he left 10 concubines to take care of the palace. That gets particularly mentioned because another ugly incident lies ahead that involves those concubines. So the king set out with all the people following him, and they halted at a place some distance away. And they're marching east from Jerusalem, which means
Mount of Olives.
They're going up the Mount of Olives. Mm-hmm. All his men, so the king set out with all the people following him, and they halted at a place some distance away. One would think that this is probably the top of the Mount of Olives, where David is taking a look back at his capital city. And we can't help but think of Jesus leaving with his disciples, and they say, "Look how beautiful the city is." And Jesus says, "Not one stone will be left on top of another." But that's stretching a little bit, you know, and get too carried away with that. But at any rate, he stops. All his men marched past him, along with all the Kerethites and Pelethites and all the 600 Gittites. Those 600 Gittites are Philistines who are loyal to David. More loyal than many others, who had accompanied him from Gath. Remember, Gath is one of those five cities of the Philistines. So they all marched, and all 600 marched before the king. So these are the people who are loyal. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You are a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday, and today shall I make you wander about with us, when I do not know where I am going?" Now, when he says you came yesterday, only yesterday, doesn't mean it was exactly the day before. You just came. You haven't been here that long. So you have no connection to me that anyone would particularly worry about. You can find a place with the new king, Absalom. So go back and take your countrymen. May kindness and faithfulness be with you. But Ittai replied to the king, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be." Reminds us of one of David's ancestors. Who?
Ruth.
Sure. David said to Ittai, "Go ahead, march on." So Ittai the Gittite marched on with all his men and the families that were with him. The whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the desert. So they're heading east, and it's from Jericho to Jerusalem, with the curves and so forth on the road, it's 17 miles. So they're marching out into the Jordan Valley, and the desert is out there. Zadok was there too, and all the Levites who were with him, and all the Levites who were with him were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. They presumed that David would want that to go with him. They set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar offered sacrifices. So you got Zadok and Abiathar, until all the people had finished leaving the city. Then the king said to Zadok, "Take the Ark of God back into the city." remember the last time it had gone. I suppose somebody was thinking, well, if the ark goes with David, that will be good for him. But when they took the ark out into battle against the Philistines captured it. And David is more concerned about the Ark of the Covenant than about David. So he says, take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, I am not pleased with you, then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. So David is saying it's in the Lord's hands. Well, with an attitude like that, Absalom should be ducking. But he doesn't have that attitude. He thinks that plots and machinations and treachery will work. The king also said to Zadok the priest, aren't you a seer? You're one who can tell God's will for the future. Go back to the city in peace with your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan, son of Abiathar. You and Abiathar, take your two sons with you. So you're the high priests. I will wait at the fords in the desert until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar took the Ark of God back to Jerusalem and stayed there. And they're really loyal to David. But David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too and were weeping as they went up. Now David had been told, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So David prayed, O Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. And when you read Psalms of David, where he talks about being surrounded by his enemies and turning to the Lord, you need to understand those songs to the Lord. They are an expression of confidence and faith in the Lord. Despite the difficulties, he knows that the Lord will deliver him. When David arrived at the summit where people used to worship God, Hushai the Archite was there to meet him, his robe torn and dust on his head. So he's expressing his sadness over the whole situation. David said to him, if you go with me, you will be a burden to me. Now, here we have to maybe do a little guessing. Hushai has been around for a very long time. And it seems as if he say, Hushai, I'm happy that you're willing to go with me, but you're too old, and you're going to be a burden. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king. I was your father's servant in the past, and now I will be your servant. Then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. So David feels very betrayed by Ahithophel's counselor going over to Absalom's side. Won't the priests Zadok and Abiathar be there with you? That's a rhetorical question. Of course they will be. And so he's telling him, these are the people you can count on. Don't trust anybody else, but you can count on these people. Tell them anything you hear in the king's palace. Now, in advanced age, he's not going to be able to get that message to David, but the sons of the high priest, Zadok and Abiathar, can. Their two sons, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, and Jonathan, son of Abiathar, are there with them. Send them to me with anything you hear, so they can be the messengers. And they should be safe because they're the priests. So David's friend Hushai arrived at Jerusalem as Absalom was entering the city. So David's only, fairly briefly ahead of Absalom. Hebron is not that far south of Jerusalem. Remember, the whole land of Israel is barely 120 miles long, Hushai has to pick his way slowly if age is really the situation here. He gets down the Mount of Olives and across the Brook Kidron and up into the city. And Absalom's coming from, would be from his left, from the south. The little details aren't that critical. Chapter 16. When David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, so he's going down the other side. That's in Jesus' day, that's Bethany, the other side of the Mount of Olives. When he had gone a short distance beyond the summit, there was Ziba, the steward of Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth is the lame son of Saul, and Ziba is
Saul.
Yeah.
He said he was the son of Saul. Mephibosheth is the son of Jonathan.
Yes, I did say Saul, didn't I? Okay, you're right. He's the son of Jonathan, correct. But Saul's family. And David, we read that last time, was not interested in killing everybody in Saul's family and making sure there was no one to oppose him. Ziba is, he's a conniver. He had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisin, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine.
I'm not going to do it. I'll take what you did to me. You send my people off into all the nations of Greece and whatever. I'm going to, in turn, do it to you. Okay.
Fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who become exhausted in the desert. You got to head out into that dry land out there. The king then asked, "Where is your master's grandson?" Ziba said to him, "He is staying in Jerusalem because he thinks today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom." That's a lie. Ziba is lying about Mephibosheth. That is not what Mephibosheth is thinking at all. He is very grateful and loyal to David. But Ziba thinks that this will gain him, and it works. Then the king said to Ziba, "All that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." Now, it's kind of sad that David would think that Mephibosheth would turn on him. But lots of things had happened, and things were not going well at all. So at any rate, he takes Ziba at his word. "I humbly bow," Ziba said, "may I find favor in your eyes, my lord the king." Now we meet this Shimei guy. As King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. So this guy has got some guts. He's really unhappy because David is surrounded by the guards, but nothing happens. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you man of blood, you scoundrel. The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul." So he's really bitter. "In whose place you have reigned. You're a usurper. The Lord has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a man of blood." Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. Take care of him." But the king said, "What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah?" See, they solve every problem violently. "If he is cursing because the Lord said to him, 'Curse David,' who can ask, 'Why do you do this?'" David then said to Abishai and all his officials, "My son, who is of my own flesh, is trying to take my life. How much more than this Benjaminite?" So if my own son wants to kill me, what do you expect from this guy from the tribe of Benjamin, which is Saul's tribe? "Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will see my distress and repay me with good for the cursing I am receiving today." So it may be that I've got this coming. And so David's very humble. But no one would recognize that. I mean, this would drive Joab crazy. So David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went and throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt. Whew. The king and all the people with him arrived at their destination exhausted, and there he refreshed himself. Now, what happens? Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back at Jerusalem, Absalom and all the men of Israel came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. Then Hushai the Archite, David's friend, went to Absalom and said to him, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" Absalom asked Hushai, "Is this the love you show your friend?" Who's the friend?
David,
right. So Absalom, is this how much you love your friend? Why didn't you go with your friend? Hushai said to Absalom, "No, the one chosen by the Lord, by these people and by all the men of Israel, his I will be, and I will remain with him." Well, you can see Absalom's weakness. And Hushai tells him, "I'm going to go with the one chosen by the Lord," like Absalom was worried about whether the Lord had chosen him or not. But that's what he needed to hear, because that's what the men of Israel would appreciate. This guy is a friend of David, and he's throwing his lot in with Absalom. So Absalom should have recognized that Hushai was not somebody to be trusted, but he gets so sucked up in his own power that he ignores it. So what happens? Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve the Son? Just as I served your father, so I will serve you. Well, that fits right in with Absalom. Time for the new generation to take over. And so Hushai says, "I'll be loyal to you." Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give us your advice. What should we do?" Ahithophel answered, "Lie with your father's concubines, whom he left to take care of the palace. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench in your father's nostrils." You're really socking it to your father. "And the hands of everyone with you will be strengthened." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and he lay with his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now in those days, the advice Ahithophel gave was like that of one who inquires of God. So he has a reputation for giving very good advice. That was how both David and Absalom regarded all of Ahithophel's advice. Ahithophel said to Absalom, "I would choose 12,000 men and set out tonight in pursuit of David." That's a pretty light force that would be able to move fast. And Ahithophel's advice is right. He says, you've got to strike David while he's reeling. Don't wait and let him organize and get himself ready. "I would attack him while he is weary and weak. I would strike him with terror, and then all the people with him will flee. I would strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you." So don't go out there and slaughter everybody, but just kill the king. "The death of the man you seek will mean the return of all. All the people will be unharmed." This plan seemed good to Absalom and to all the elders of Israel. So they like Ahithophel's advice. But Absalom said, "Summon also Hushai the Archite." Fatal error. "So we can hear what he has to say." When Hushai came to him, Absalom said, "Ahithophel has given this advice. Should we do what he says? If not, give us your opinion." Well, that's the kind of thing that leaders do. Hushai replied to Absalom, "The advice Ahithophel has given you is not good this time. You know your father and his men. They are fighters, and as fierce as a wild bear robbed of her cubs. Besides, your father is an experienced fighter." So Hushai is suggesting that Ahithophel is saying, strike quickly, get him while he's weary and tired and reeling. And Hushai is saying, remember how good your father is. Your father is an experienced fighter. He will not spend the night with his troops. So you're not going to be able to accomplish it, to kill the king. Even now he is hidden in a cave or some other place. If he should attack your troops first, whoever hears about it will say, there has been a slaughter among the troops who follow Absalom. So if he strikes first, meaning he strikes a blow, that's not going to look good, and people will hear that Absalom's troops are getting clobbered. Then even the bravest soldier, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a fighter, and that those with him are brave. So Ahithophel is saying, strike while the iron is hot. It's clearly the best advice. But David has got his man in there. So I advise you, let all Israel from Dan to Beersheba, that's Dan in the north, Beersheba in the south, for it's like from sea to shining sea, or something like that. As numerous as the sand on the seashore, be gathered to you, with you yourself leading them into battle. Well, that Absalom kind of likes that, you know. Big army, getting everything ready. Then we will attack him wherever he may be found, and we will fall on him as dew settles on the ground. Neither he nor any of his men will be left alive. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we will drag it down to the valley. What valley?
Jordan?
No.
No.
Kidron?
It's not a name. Where do you build a city? You always build the city on the high ground.
On a hill.
Right. So, yeah, that's what the reference is. So we're going to, not one stone will be left on top of another, thinking of Jerusalem. And we will drag it down to the valley until not even a piece of it can be found. Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel. There's strength in numbers. See, they don't like the bold tactics that are really the right ones. For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom. That's why they went along. The Lord was guiding this. Hushai told Zadok and Abiathar the priests, Ahithophel has advised Absalom and the elders of Israel to do such and such, but I have advised them to do so and so. So such and such and so is not wanting to repeat everything that was advised. Now send a message immediately and tell David, do not spend the night at the fords in the desert. Cross over without fail, or the king and all the people with him will be swallowed up. So keep on going. Jonathan and Ahimaaz were staying at En-Rogel. A servant girl was to go and inform them. These are the sons of the priests. And they were to go and tell King David, for they could not risk being seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So the two of them left quickly and went to the house of a man in Bahurim. Well, that's where David had headed in that direction. He had a well in his courtyard, and they climbed down into it. Well, now, if you're making a movie of what happened, these two guys got spotted, and they just get out of the city by the skin of their teeth, and they flee to Bahurim. Well, then what happens? The fellow there had a well in his courtyard, and they climbed down into it. His wife took a covering and spread it out over the opening of the well and scattered grain over it. No one knew anything about it. So it's harvest time, you know, and it just looks like a threshing floor, I guess. But at any rate, they camouflaged it and hid it. When Absalom's men came to the woman at the house, they asked, where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan? The woman answered them, they crossed over the brook. The men searched but found no one, so they returned to Jerusalem. After the men had gone, the two climbed out of the well and went to inform King David. They said to him, set out and cross the river at once. Ahithophel has advised such and such against you. And it's the possibility that that advice would be carried out. So get across the river, the Jordan, out into the desert. At daybreak, no one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. When Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and set out for his house in his hometown. He put his house in order and then hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. He's thrown his lot in with Absalom. Absalom's made a fatal mistake in his view, so it's all over. David went to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. So that was Hushai's advice, and they've gathered them all. Absalom had appointed Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Jether, an Israelite who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, and sister of Zeruiah, the mother of Joab. So all related. The Israelites and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. That's Transjordan. What was Gilead famous for?
Balm.
The balm of Gilead. So they made balm from the trees there.
Pastor, was that east of Jericho, where Jericho would be?
No, it'd be probably more
northeast.
North. Yeah, east of the Jordan and north into Gilead, right. So they fled from Jerusalem, that's what they've done. And we don't know that they probably would not have gone to Jericho. They probably would have headed north and east, both, because they wouldn't be want to be on the road. That's a guess, though. Who knows? All right, verse 27. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, remember David had defeated the Ammonites, and Machir, son of Amiel from Lo Debar, remember Lo Debar? No pasture. That's a little town, no pasture. And Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery, so they brought some supplies. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, sheep and cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat. For they said, the people have become hungry and tired and thirsty in the desert. So they're out there in that dry land. All right, chapter 18. David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. So David is organizing his people. Again, if you're doing a movie, David knows how to do this. So you would see the confidence of his men building. David's back on his game, if you will. David sent the troops out, a third under the command of Joab, a third under Joab's brother Abishai, son of Zeruiah, and a third under Ittai, the Philistine, the Gittite. The Gittites are the people from Gath. The king told the troops, I myself will surely march out with you. But the men said, you must not go out. If we are forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. So what they're saying is, if you go with us, it's going to be to our disadvantage, because they're going to go after you. The king answered, I will do, or it would be better now for you to give us support from the city. The king answered, I will do whatever seems best to you. So the city is Mahanaim. So the king stood beside the gate while all the men marched out in units of hundreds and of thousands. The king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake. And when David says that, I don't know about Abishai and Ittai. Well, I do. But Joab rolls his eyes. So the army marched into the field to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. Now, there's no forest left there. It hasn't been for centuries. But there was then. There, the army of Israel was defeated by David's men. Now, the chronicler doesn't tell us the strategy. He divided it up into three groups. Who knows what they did? Didn't think it was important to tell us. Yeah.
Is that the first time we hear that? When I read that,
we hear what?
That Israel was fighting Judah or David.
Yeah, probably. But remember, that Absalom had declared his rebellion in Hebron, which is not in Israel, it's in Judah. It's to the south. So, but still, we're one nation at this point. So David's men are defeating the army of Israel that has rallied to Absalom. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest claimed more lives that day than the sword. Now, you know, it doesn't necessarily literally mean that they ran head-on into trees and fell dead or something like that. The forest, David's men were ready to fight in the forest, and the army of Israel was not. And so it wasn't so much that David's men were militarily superior, they just had better strategy, and they used the forest to their advantage. And as a result, they were killed, but they were probably killed by the sword. But at any rate, Israel loses badly. Now Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's head got caught in the tree. And because of the talk, the chronicler wants to tell us about that 5-pound hair. Tradition says that his hair got caught. But that's not what, you know, it's not a big deal. He was left hanging in midair while the mule he was riding kept on going. One of the men saw this. When one of the men saw this, he told Joab, "I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to the man who told him this, "What? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have had to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt of metal." You know. But the man replied, "Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I would not lift my hand against the king's son. I know David. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and nothing is hidden from the king, it's all going to get back to the king, you would have kept your distance from me." So you wanted me to kill him, and you're going to give me a medal and some shekels and so forth. But when the king found out, you wouldn't be anywhere to be found. Joab said, "I'm not going to wait like this for you." So he took 3 javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Now, what exactly that is, they went with him. Maybe he was looking for cover. I don't know. You know, but Joab killed Absalom. Then Joab sounded the trumpet, and the troops stopped pursuing Israel, for Joab halted them. They took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest, and piled up a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. Complete defeat. Absalom is dead. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself, for he thought, "I have no son to carry on the memory of my name." He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. And that's mentioned because all he ended up with was this pile of rocks in a pit. Now Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said, "Let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies." "You are not the one to take the news today," Joab told him. "You may take the news another time, but you must not do so today because the king's son is dead." And probably Ahimaaz said, "Yeah, I think you're right. I don't want to take the news." Then Joab said to a Cushite, "Go tell the king what you have seen." The Cushite bowed down before Joab and ran off. He doesn't really know what's going on. He's a Cushite. Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, again said to Joab, "Come what may, please let me run behind the Cushite." But Joab replied, "My son, why do you want to go? You don't have any news that will bring you a reward." He said, "Come what may, I want to run." I've got to run. It's in my blood. So Joab said, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and outran the Cushite. And the plain is the valley of the Jordan. So perhaps the Cushite had headed up into the mountains. I mean, I don't know. Maybe because he didn't want to run into any of the soldiers of Israel or what. Don't know. But at any rate, Ahimaaz outruns him. While David was sitting between the inner and outer gates at Mahanaim, the watchman went up to the roof of the gateway by the wall. As he looked out, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out to the king and reported it. The king said, if he is alone, he must have good news. Because if you have good news, you'd send somebody out. If you got wiped out, you'd come straggling back altogether. Then the watchman saw another man running, and he said down to the gatekeeper, look, another man running alone. The king said, he must be bringing good news too. For the same reason. The watchman said, it seems to me that the first one runs like Ahimaaz, son of Zadok. So he was, he could recognize him from a long distance. He's a good man, the king said, he comes with good news. Then Ahimaaz called out to the king, all is well. He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted up their hands against my lord the king. The king asked, is the young man Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was. The king said, stand aside and wait here. So he stepped aside and stood there. So the other guy is running up now. Then the Cushite arrived and said, my lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you. The king asked the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? The Cushite replied, may all the enemies of the Lord, my lord the king, and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man. The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. Great music written about Absalom. What was David's sorrow? Well, Absalom, I think, had no relationship with the Lord. And now he's dead. And so David is very, very sad, but he, well, Joab would have certainly seen it as weakness on his part, but very few people know the name of Joab, and everybody knows the name of David, so, all right, chapter 19. Joab was told, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom, and for the whole army the victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day the troops heard it said, the king is grieving for his son. The men stole into the city that day as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. So they came back as if they had lost and were in ignominious retreat, when in fact they should have been coming back celebrating. But David is mourning. The king covered his face and cried aloud, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab went into the house to the king and said, today you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You're nuts, David. You don't have the sense you were born with. You have made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom was alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you since your youth until now. This is a complete disaster, David, and you've got to straighten it out. So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told, the king is sitting in the gateway, they all came before him. So we get to celebrate our victory. Meanwhile, the Israelites had fled to their homes. Throughout the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with each other, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He is the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he has fled the country because of Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed to rule over us, has died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back? And they're seeing that that needs to happen. King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Ask the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his palace, since what is being said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? So Judah is hanging back. You are my brothers, my own flesh and blood, so why should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab. So David's finally had it with Joab. And so he says, well, I'll get Amasa to take his place, and then he'll be loyal. He won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, return, you and all your men. Then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan. Now the men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan. That's kind of significant, isn't it? Because the children of Israel, when they were coming from the victory in Egypt, took them 40 years to get there, but nevertheless they were there, they crossed the Jordan. When Jesus started his ministry, he started from the Jordan, where John baptized him. All right. Shimei, son of Gera, he's our favorite guy, the Benjaminite from Bahurim, hurried down with the men of Judah to meet King David. With him were 1,000 Benjaminites, along with Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. They rushed to the Jordan where the king was. They crossed at the ford to take the king's household over and to do whatever he wished.
This is the Ziba that was throwing rocks at him?
No, Shimei.
Oh,
Ziba is Mephibosheth's servant, who has told him that Mephibosheth was disloyal to him.
That's right.
That's Ziba. So Shimei is now that as long as he thought that David was a big loser, he's willing to take a risk. Maybe, you know, would people know that David would react the way he did? I mean, we have no idea. But they're all happy now. David's the king and so forth. When Shimei, son of Gera, crossed the Jordan, he fell prostrate before the king and said to him, may my Lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember your servant how your servant did wrong on the day my Lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind, for I, your servant, know that I have sinned. But today I've come here as the first of the whole house of Joseph to come down and meet my Lord the king. Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said, shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed. David replied, what do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? God does not like them. They fight, but they're vengeful guys. This day you have become my adversary. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today, do I not know that today I am king over Israel? So the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king promised him on oath. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also went down to meet the king. He had not taken care of his feet, or trimmed his mustache, or washed his clothes from the day the king left until the day he returned safely. So he's not looking too good. The little Howard Hughes imitation there. All right. When he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? When I left Jerusalem, why didn't you go with me? He said, my lord the king, since I, your servant, am lame, I said, I will have my donkey saddled and will ride on it so I can go with the king. But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me, and he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. My lord the king is like an angel of God. So do whatever pleases. So he tells me, you know, what happened is I was betrayed by Ziba. All my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord the king, but you gave your servant a place among those who sat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? The king said to him, why say more? I order you and Ziba to divide the fields. Mephibosheth said to the king, let him take everything now that my lord the king has arrived home safely. You can have it all. Barzillai the Gileadite also came down from Rogelim to cross the Jordan with the king and to send him on his way from there. Now Barzillai was a very old man, 80 years of age. He had provided for the king during his stay in Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. The king said to Barzillai, cross over with me and stay with me in Jerusalem, and I will provide for you. But Barzillai answered the king, how many more years will I live that I should go up to Jerusalem with the king? What am I going to do there? I'm now 80 years old. Can I tell the difference between what is good and what is not? He's got a little like Alzheimer's. Can your servant taste what he eats and drinks? Can I still hear the voices of men and women singers? So can't taste, can't hear. It's tough to get old. It's not for the young and inexperienced. Why should your servant be an added burden to the Lord my king, to my lord the king? Your servant will cross over the Jordan with the king for a short distance. I'll be happy to march triumphantly with you. But why should the king reward me in this way? Let your servant return that I may die in my own town near the tomb of my father and mother. But here is your servant Kimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king. Do for him whatever pleases you. So apparently this Kimham is someone close to Barzillai, and he's saying, you know, you assist David. The king said, Kimham will cross over with me, and I will do for him whatever pleases you, and anything you desire from me, I will do for you. So all the people crossed the Jordan, and, you know, just a short time before that, David had snuck across at night. So the Lord is with him. When the king crossed over to Gilgal, Kimham crossed with him. All the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. Soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying to him, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all his men? So we're seeing the problems are escalating between Judah and Israel, and of course it's going to lead to a division. There's going to be the southern kingdom, Judah, and the northern kingdom, Israel. All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, we did this because the king is closely related to us. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything for ourselves? It's a plague on both their houses. You know. Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, and besides, we have a greater claim on David than you have. So why do you treat us with contempt? What 10 shares do they have?
10 tribes?
Yeah, they're the 10 tribes.
Were there only two, Benjamin and Judah?
And Judah, yeah, right. So why do you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? But the men of Judah responded even more harshly than the men of Israel. So it's not going well. All right. Now a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, happened to be there. He sounded the trumpet and shouted, we have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, O Israel. So all the men of Israel deserted David to follow Sheba, son of Bichri. But the men of Judah stayed by their king all the way from the Jordan to Jerusalem. Now, what is this? Well, it's kind of hard to say. Is it? Well, we'll see. When David returned to his palace in Jerusalem, he took the 10 concubines he had left to take care of the palace and put them in a house under guard. He provided for them, but did not lie with them. They were kept in confinement till the day of their death, living as widows. Then the king said to Amasa, summon the men of Judah to come with me within 3 days and be here yourself. He's the new general, chief of staff or whatever. But when Amasa went to summon Judah, he took longer than the time the king had set for him. David said to Abishai, now Sheba, son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom did. Take your master's men and pursue him. So, you know, Amasa hasn't gotten back. Or he will find fortified cities and escape from us. So Joab's men and the Kerethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty warriors went out under the command of Abishai. David doesn't like him, but he's there willing to fight. They marched out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba son of Bichri. While they were at the great rock in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Joab was wearing his military tunic, and strapped over it at his waist was a belt with a dagger in its sheath. As he stepped forward, it dropped out of its sheath. Joab said to Amasa, "How are you, my brother?" Then Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Amasa was not on his guard against the dagger in Joab's hand, and Joab plunged it into his belly, and his intestines spilled out on the ground. Without being stabbed again, Amasa died. Then Joab and his brother Abishai pursued Sheba, son of Bichri. So they got rid of Amasa. One of Joab's men stood beside Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the road, and the man saw that all the troops came to a halt there. When he realized that everyone who came up to Amasa stopped, he dragged him from the road into a field and threw a garment over him. After Amasa had been removed from the road, all the men went on with Joab to pursue Sheba, son of Bichri. So, you know, they didn't want to get involved in this battle between Joab and Amasa. So when the body is lying there, they don't know what to do. So he drags it out of the way. Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel Beth Maacah and through the entire region of the Beerites, who gathered together and followed him. All the troops with Joab came and besieged Sheba and Abel Beth Maacah. They built a siege ramp up to the city, and it stood against the outer fortifications. While they were battering the wall to bring it down, a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab to come here so I can speak to him." He went toward her, and she asked, "Are you Joab?" "I am," he answered. She said, "Listen to what your servant has to say." "I'm listening," he said. She continued, "Long ago they used to say, 'Get your answer at Abel.'" That's the name of the town, Abel Beth. "And that settled it. We are the peaceful and faithful in Israel. You are trying to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why do you want to swallow up the Lord's inheritance?" "Far be it from me," Joab replied. "Far be it from me to swallow up or destroy. This is not the case. A man named Sheba, son of Bichri, from the hill country of Ephraim, has lifted up his hand against the king, against David. Hand over this one man, and I'll withdraw from the city." The woman said to Joab, "His head will be thrown to you from the wall." Then the woman went to all the people with her wise advice, and they cut off the head of Sheba, son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. So he sounded the trumpet, and his men dispersed from the city, each returning to his home. And Joab went back to the king in Jerusalem. Joab was over Israel's entire army. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites. Adoniram was in charge of forced labor. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder. Sheva was secretary. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira, the Jairite, was David's priest.
His cabinet.
Pardon?
His cabinet.
Yeah, his cabinet, right. Again, notice how the chronicler tells the stories that help to explain David. We don't hear anything about all. David was a powerful king who accomplished many things, but the chronicler does not dwell on those. All right, well, let's go to the Gibeonites, I guess. During the reign of David, there was a famine for three successive years. So once again, we're not going chronologically. This is now another event. So David sought the face of the Lord. The Lord said, "It is on account of Saul and his blood-stained house. It is because he put the Gibeonites to death." The king summoned the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not a part of Israel, but were survivors of the Amorites. The Israelites had sworn to spare them, but Saul in his zeal for Israel and Judah had tried to annihilate them. David asked the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? How shall I make amends so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance?" The Gibeonites answered him, "We have no right to demand silver or gold from Saul or his family, nor do we have the right to put anyone in Israel to death. "What do you want me to do for you?" David asked. They answered the king, "As for the man who destroyed us and plotted against us so that we have been decimated and have no place anywhere in Israel, let 7 of his male descendants be given to us to be killed and exposed before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the Lord's chosen one." So the king said, "I will give them to you." The king spared Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, because of the oath before the Lord between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. But the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the 2 sons of Aiah's daughter Rizpah, whom she had borne to Saul, together with 5 sons of Saul's daughter Merab, whom she had borne to Adriel, son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. He handed them over to the Gibeonites, who killed and exposed them on a hill before the Lord. All 7 of them fell together. They were put to death during the first days of the harvest, just as the barley harvest was beginning. So again, we're being told what exactly was happening, and the way that David dealt with situations where Israel had been unfaithful. Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it out for herself on a rock. From the beginning of the harvest till the rain poured down from the heavens on the bodies, she did not let the birds of the air touch them by day or the wild animals by night. So that's a long time, months from the barley harvest to the winter rains. When David was told what Aiah's daughter Rizpah, Saul's concubine, had done, he went and took the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan from the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead. They had taken them secretly from the public square at Beit Shan, where the Philistines had hung them after they struck Saul down on Gilboa. David brought the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan from there, and the bones of those who had been killed and exposed were gathered up. They buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the tomb of Saul's father Kish at Zelah in Benjamin, and they did everything the king commanded. After that, God answered prayer in behalf of the land. So this unfaithfulness of Saul to the promise that had been made to the Gibeonites was a curse on the land. And David avenged that and settled it. And chances are, I would guess, that this happened fairly close to the time of Saul rather than way at the end of David's reign when it would have largely been forgotten. This was something that needed to be taken care of. So David did it early in his reign.
Pastor, were these 7 who were given over by King David, were they from Judah? Tribe of Judah?
They would have been from the tribe of Benjamin. They were Saul's family. Yeah. Right. So, all right, that's a good place to stop. We're at that time. Now remember, next Wednesday, the pastors are in North Hollywood for District Pastoral Conference on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Returning on Thursday. So then 2 weeks from tonight, President John Buchholz, I'm trying to think, I want to say one. John Buchholz will be here to meet with the congregation. He is in his first term as district president, and his desire is to get to know the congregations. It's probably less important for our congregation from the point of view of calling than it would be for a smaller congregation with one pastor, because then the pastor's taken a call, he's gone. Now, where does the congregation want to go? We're much more prepared, just because of the situation, to know where we're going. But he wishes to be here and hear from the members. So that's an open forum, and he'll run the meeting. If you... let's see, do we have any? Yeah, there's a couple here. If you don't have one of these pre-call meeting surveys, this is from President Buchholz. There are 2 here. There are more at church. You can pick one up. we urge you to, it's very thoughtful. It'll take you a little time to think it through and work it out. But he does not want us to compile these. He just wants us to give us the stack, and we'll look, and he'll look through them. So I think between the meeting and the things that people write, he'll get a good feeling for St. Mark's, and that's a good thing. So 3 weeks from today, we'll meet.